As I record this, I'm 3,000 miles from home, sitting in Florida as my dad and hero, Stan Perlman, completes his 81 years of life in hospice care thanks to a brutal bout of pancreatic cancer. And today, while lying in bed barely conscious, my dad was sung to via phone by Lisa, the rabbi from a small synagogue. And even though my dad is weak and drugged up, he definitely heard her beautiful voice. And it reminded me that the power of communication, via music, via poetry, via books, via articles, has touched and moved people for centuries. And as I sit here, trying to make sense of it all, I just find that important to remember. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Bob Rose, the longtime media relations guru for teams ranging from the San Francisco Giants and Oakland A's to the Cal Bears of the Aaron Rodgers heyday and the Los Angeles Express of Steve Young. This is episode number 342. Let's sing some Yang.
Okay, a little while, but he's with it.
Bob, thank you for doing this. And I want to say, you gave me a warning. You gave me a warning, and you said your hearing is not the best, and you actually just blamed Tom Petty. What did Tom Petty do?
I do. Actually, one of the better concerts I ever saw was the Tom Petty Allman Brothers double bill in St. Petersburg, probably like, 30 years ago. And it has now led me that I've discarded all pride and ego, and I have hearing aids, which sometimes work. So I'm just letting you know. So if you ask me questions and I say what, you'll know why.
Can we actually connect your hearing loss directly to Tom Petty and the Allman Brothers?
I had great seats, but they were very close to speakers. My ears were ringing for days. If I look back, I think that's why.
So I usually have journalists on this podcast, and I thought it would be interesting to have someone like you who's had a long career in PR and media relations. You started in 1973 as the SID at your alma mater, Pepperdine, and you've in the ensuing years, you worked Stanford, you worked at the old USFL, you worked at the World League, you worked for Phoenix Cardinals, St. Louis Cardinals at that point. You worked for the Giants, worked for the A's. I mean, a million different places. When I think of you, and you may not like this connection, but when I think of you professionally, I think of Barry Bonds, because you were at the Giants during Bonds' heyday. You got there in 93. Bonds arrived in 1993. You were there through 2001. That was the year Bonds hit 73 home runs. I've always thought Bonds seemed to enjoy making my life, and by my, I mean my, a member of the media, my life much more difficult. And I think in a way, he probably enjoyed making your life miserable. Like, he seemed to just be a guy who enjoyed wielding the power of misery. Am I misunderstanding what Barry Bonds was?
Well, being the PR guy for the team, one of your more important things is to deliver the interview, right? Deliver the player or the coach to the media. This is a guy who did not enjoy that aspect of sports. And so you can imagine, every day was very difficult. I would say this. I'm a pretty honest guy. I'm going to tell you exactly, because I believe in the truth. Yes, do I massage, emphasize the most positive part? Sure, that's my job. That's what I get paid for. But in the case of Bonds, there are people on the outside that just would say, well, you know, great player and, yeah, he took steroids. Yeah, you know, but really, he just didn't like dealing with the media. He didn't like the media. And that is such a small silo. Barry, I can honestly say, didn't get along with pretty much everybody. It wasn't about just the media. I mean, I literally would watch him in the clubhouse with ball boys, Mike Murphy, the equipment manager, beloved equipment man. Well, I mean, I don't think you can just limit it to the media. I do think this, and I'm not a psychologist, so you know, he'd be an interesting study, because I think he thought that he needed to have this these negative vibes. He needed to create this conflict, and a lot of it was with the media, in order for him to be ready to perform on the field. There were more than one time when maybe I had a good day and he did a couple of interviews and then he went 0-for-4 and he'd come in and say, see, I told you, you know. So I think there is some of that with Barry. It's too bad, you know, for a guy who's actually a pretty smart guy, that he didn't understand people in the media included. They want to like this guy because he's such an amazing guy to watch play baseball. And if he just would have just done the minimum, you know, a good example is with that same Giant team in those early 90s, Matt Williams, who's a really good guy. But Matt didn't really enjoy doing media interviews, but he was so well-mannered in turning people down. I mean, he was a nice guy. He wasn't trying to make it was up me against you. For the most part, people just kind of respected him. But in Barry's case, he did make life very difficult. And it's too bad, because I joke about it, because I had, you know, I've had a lot of top athletes in my day. I had Elway, I had Steve Young, I had Deion Sanders for half a season. But he just never understood that all he did, just do the minimum. I don't know if he enjoyed it or not. I enjoyed making our lives miserable. But, you know, anybody who covered him at all, not to mention a PR guy who had him for 10 years, we all have issues.
When I was doing a lot of Giants when I was at Sports Illustrated, there was this debate among writers that you would hear, and it would be, who is worse to deal with, Jeff Kent or Barry Bonds? And people would literally debate Kent Bonds. Yeah. I always found Kent okay. Not amazing, but okay. Was Kent tough too for you?
Jeff could be ornery. you used to joke about it. There was some name they used. Like, they had another first name for him. It was Mike. And it was like, oh, no, he's Mike today. He's not Jeff today. But he also had his days where he was fine. Jeff was such a perfectionist that he wanted everything done exactly right. And not only did he approach it himself as a player, but he also expected everybody around him to do it exactly right. And if you didn't do it right, and I used to have conversations with my interns. I just said, hey, listen, this guy wants it. If you're around him or you have to do something, it's important. I said, but it's a good lesson to learn of all professional athletes, because professional athletes, their mentality is, if I don't perform, I get sent down or I get waived. So if you're a PR person or you're a community relations person and you drop the ball, well, then you should be waived. That's the mentality. But Jeff, I couldn't even compare Jeff with Barry. Jeff didn't outwardly kind of go after you. Barry occasionally would. So as you get older and more mature, you try to understand more. Like my first year with the Giants in 93 was also Will Clark's last year. And Will Clark had such a warm spot in the hearts of Giant fans. They loved him. You know, he was a wound tight from, you know, rural Louisiana. But he was had a sweet swing, and he had, you know, the big hits in the 89 playoffs and so forth. And Will and Kent didn't come until 97. Will with Barry, that was difficult for me. That was my first year in baseball. And Will was not was not easy. And I think it was because it was a hard year for him. He played all year hurt. He had a bad elbow. And so he's hitting all these warning track fly balls. And Barry's kind of taken over the team just by performance. You know, Dusty was smart enough to say, Will, you're going to bat third for me this year, no matter what. Because everybody's like, oh, you should put Barry third. He's a pretty typical third place hitter. He can run. I said, no, you know what? There's a lot going to be taken away from Will this year. I'm not going to take away his third spot in the lineup. And so Will was hard. Will was difficult. But I kind of understood. And the difference, I think, also between him and Barry is years later, not that I ever had that conversation with Will, but, you know, this is after I was well gone from the Giants. He came up and just couldn't have been nicer. And it was kind of, I think, his way of letting me know that was not an easy year. Whereas Bonds, I won't even say what he said the first time I saw him back. other than it was an expletive deleted thing of, you know, what are you doing here? So there's a difference.
Did that hurt your feelings when you see Bonds for the first time afterward?
And hurt my feelings?
Yeah.
Sure. Sure. I think I'd also, for me personally, a couple things. One is that while I started out in college PR, and I went from Pepperdine to Stanford, and it was at Stanford at a good time. And they, even though their team, football team, didn't go any bowl games, they did have Elway. They did have a good team. And then I went to the NFL. And first of all, the NFL at that time was a school of Pete Rozelle, and who was a foreign PR guy. So you really kind of learned a certain way to do things. And anybody who covered the NFL also knows very regimented. You know, they're very controlled the way that they present their players to the media and so forth. It isn't a baseball clubhouse where it's open before the game and you can wander around and so forth. That's not the case in football. So that was kind of my background. So when I get into baseball in 93, I knew baseball was going to be different. I didn't know how different, but it was a lot different. But then you're dealing with a guy like Barry Bonds, who I never had. And the thing was, it came on quickly. First, I hadn't even been offered the Giants job. I had been in the World League. It had been suspended. And I'm going through the interview process for the PR job. And I'm at home in Greenwich, Connecticut. And I'm watching on TV in the winter meetings in Louisville that the Giants have just signed Barry Bonds in this monster contract. And I knew, just based on what I've been following Bonds over the years, that my job was getting more difficult. I knew that when he was signed. So now I get to spring training and I ask Barry, hey, do you think we could, you know, the first week or two, because the workouts are short, you know, maybe we could grab a late lunch or something. I'd just like to get to know you. I'm going to be working with you every day. And his response was no. That was it. And then we get into the season, and it was unusual because Bonds was traditionally a late starter. He didn't get off quick. Then he'd get hot. But he comes to the Giants, and he's hot from the get-go. So he is the story in April for baseball. I mean, he's the returning two-time MVP, and he's got the best numbers in baseball. So I got baptized real quick because, you know, there's a lot of national media that wanted to come out. And I was having difficulty delivering any interviews. That was when the Richard Hoffer, I'm Barry Bonds and you're not, cover story of Sports Illustrated came out. He came out. I always make a point when a guy says, hey, listen, when you make a commitment, you make a commitment. But Barry never even committed. He wouldn't even commit. He'd had some bad experience with Sports Illustrated. So anyway, Hoffer comes out. That's what happened. And I can remember because he didn't. I'm not sure he ever talked to him. Because, you know, Richard was basically going, okay, well, I'm just going to go into scrums every day, and then I'm going to observe things, and that's going to be my man, and I'll talk to other people, and that's going to be it. So that was my first cross-country media person doing a story. Then I already had set up a interview with, remember, there used to be a Sports Illustrated for kids.
Yeah.
As harmless as it's going to get, right? And they want to do a cover story, and he's going, I'm not going to do it. I'm not doing it. So they're coming out. I said, Barry. And I think it's the only time I really almost demanded, because I think you have to walk. I mean, everybody walks softly around Barry Bonds. By the end of the 10 years, I did my job. I asked him the interview. If he didn't do it, I say, fine. But anyway, Sports Illustrated for Kids, finished the story. I just kind of demanded this. You're going to do this, Barry. In fact, you need to do this. And he ended up doing it. You know, you really need to try to understand how he thought. But you know what? I don't think I ever did. I don't know if he ever really considered me more than the ball-headed PR guy who walked around going, well, what do you need now? You know, and I tried. I certainly had relations with other players, but he was one of those guys. You know, he just, he was in his world, and you were just lucky to be living in it. It was tough. I felt bad for a lot of people. I felt bad for Willie Mays, Willie McCovey. First of all, he roars by their home run totals, and we know it wasn't just a natural ability. And then as a Giant organization, we're parading these two Willies out there with him. And of course, Mays is his godfather. You know, we parade him out there on the field. It was kind of what was wrong with the steroid era. You know, it kind of lessened in some ways the achievement of some truly great guys that came before them.
I got to Sports Illustrated in 1996, and I was covering baseball starting in 97-ish. And I feel like we were all very late to really be aware of performance enhancers in baseball and the impact. And you're in the locker room every day, but you work for the team. So obviously you're not breaking stories. Are you thinking in your head, you guys are missing an enormous story here that is blatantly obvious?
Where it really came to me with the Giants was in 99 spring training. I mean, which is not an unusual story. Other people say the same thing. Put it in the setting that Bonds and Ken Griffey Jr. were absolutely considered the players of the decade. But by the end of that decade, McGuire and Socia are just absolutely engulfing the entire sport. There are those that ignore the whole steroid thing and just say, oh, they save baseball. Well, you know, I'm not sure if they save baseball. Maybe they were cartoon characters, as Bob Costas would say. But by the end of that decade, here's Bonds, who's knowing he's got the same or more talent than these guys, and he's seeing them getting all the attention. And he comes to spring training in 99, and he is noticeably larger. And I'm noticing in the first week that he's there, he's hitting fly balls. This is before we even got to a game. He's just hitting fly balls at the minor league facility. And I'm just going, those balls are going a lot farther than I remember before now. And so you kind of said, hey, what's up? What's up? But then you started, it didn't take long to kind of figure it out. I left at the end of 01. So yeah, there was a lot of steroid users, I think, in that clubhouse by then, but I didn't know that. And a lot of it kind of came out later. But I think I'm right in saying this. I think people, whether you're a journalist, whether you're a PR person, or you're just in the sport, or you're just a fan, if you're a real fan, if you're a purist, you really, and baseball is one of those sports where the numbers do matter and all those things. I don't know if I felt the media, even though they missed the story, I felt badly that the commissioner of baseball and the people who are in charge of baseball didn't step in. This is a classic case, and over the years, I've been involved both NFL, Major League Baseball, college, where sometimes, because you have a lot of attorneys that are involved, or maybe the commissioner is an attorney, and they will not do the right thing for public opinion, or just the right thing in general, because they're worried about a lawsuit. You know, and at the end of the day, I have always contended, hey, take them on. If it's the right thing, even if you have to deal with a lawsuit, you're going to gain so much from fans, from the media, who are going to write much more positive about what you're doing and so forth. And I thought, again, just like the symbol watching the two Willies and Barry on the field, I always felt the same way when I used to watch Hank Aaron with Bud Selig. I said, here's a guy who I still consider the home run king. And I met Hank Aaron, and he is talking about a guy with deep character. Yeah, he was a guy with deep character. And then here's Bud Selig, who was the man in charge. And, you know, that I think those years that they didn't do anything really cost them.
Well, I remember when I think you were gone at this point from the Giants, when they really had to arm wrestle Hank Aaron he wouldn't come to the game when Bonds broke the all-time record. And they got him to do a real lukewarm video on the screen. In hindsight, but even at the time, it just struck me as mean. Like, yeah, this guy went through so much racism, so much vile stuff to break that record. And Bonds had the audacity to talk about how, why he was getting backlash because he was black. And it is theoretically possible that's true. Like, it's possible that was part of it. But if you treat everybody you encounter like shit and you cheat, I don't really think you have the right to use the same thing that Hank Aaron was going through.
Yeah.
No, it just made me so angry.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, you know, we can all, you know, I'm sure people can say things about me, but, you know, Barry Bonds grew up privileged. It was not necessarily a functional childhood, because his father was very open about that he was a recovering alcoholic, not to mention he moved around and so forth. But he grew up in a very nice home in, he went to Sarah High School, which is the same high school that Tom Brady went to. It's a very, very nice private Catholic school. So, yeah, there's that. It's not my best interest, but I'm pretty opinionated about steroids in general. I understand that it's not just the players that benefited. It's also the teams, the owners, the managers, some of which are in the Hall of Fame. I mean, I understand that it wasn't just the players that benefited. But I also felt when they start talking about Hall of Fame, And again, some people will say, well, why should there be a character clause at all? And maybe there should be. I don't know. But there is. But the point I'd look at is exactly kind of what you said. Hey, they made millions and millions of dollars off of this. They have multiple homes. They have yachts. They got the adoration of the fans. And to this day, you know, most of the Bay Area still loves Barry Bonds. They never would even want to talk about the students. So they have all of that. Isn't that enough? I mean, do they really need to be in the Hall of Fame when clearly there's something here that doesn't smell right? You know, I still to this day, I look at the wall and I've been to a few Giants games this year and they have the home run totals on the wall. I have real problems seeing Willie Mays blow him. I just do.
One of my favorite things about you, by far, hands down, 1982, December 82, April 85, the director of public relations for maybe my favorite team of all time, the Los Angeles Express of the United States Football League. And you worked for Bill Oldenburg for much of that time, an owner who could not pay bills. You had Steve Young, a quarterback who had at the time a sort of insane contract of $40 million and blah, blah, blah. You had a defensive lineman named Greg Fields punch the head coach, John Hadel. What was it like working for the L.A. Express?
Well, first of all, I made dear friends. I think that's one thing that's kind of cool about startup football leagues, is that we're all kind of thrown together. In my case, I'd already had a little bit of a career. There's others that, you know, dear friend of mine was Chris Dufresne, who passed away way before his time. But he was a prep writer at L.A. Times, and then he gets the beat with the L.A. Express. There's so many things for the L.A. Express. I mean, first of all, there's some bizarre scenes involved here. The characters are just all over the place. Steve Young, I mean, he would always come in my office in between team meetings, you know, and he's reading the L.A. Times. And Steve was the kind of guy that if he read something on the front page of the L.A. Times, even if it didn't affect him directly, but it was some horrible catastrophe, he'd be bothered about that all day. He'd come later in the day. I can't believe it. You know, 500 people died in that earthquake. You know, that was Steve Young. He also had kind of an amazing assemblage of football icons that were running the team. I mean, you had Don Klosterman as your general manager, who had been the, you know, the Duke of Dining out in L.A. and was the L.A. Rams general manager. You had John Hadel as your head coach, the great Charger quarterback. You had Sid Gilman as the offensive coordinator, who's the father of the modern passing game. I think our defensive coordinator initially was a guy named Pokey Allen, who's actually very good, but he got fired literally on a plane flight back from Oakland to L.A. after the Express shut out the Invaders. He gets fired on the plane because Ray Malavasi, an old Rams friend of Klosterman and Hadel, is available. So they hire him. We had Tom Fears, who was still one of the greatest wide receivers in the history of the NFL, was our director of player personnel. You had a situation, which is not uncommon to startup football leagues, where cash becomes short. And so you would have players who were getting signed for big money. There were players that were, a lot of them were going to go in the first round in the NFL. They had a number of players that were going to go in the first round of the NFL. And so they had to offer more money to come to the Express, which they did. And Bill Oldenburg, while he had the money, he would pay these guys. So we had all these guys that were driving up in the parking lot at this facility, which was a renovated elementary school is what it was. And they'd be parking in their Jaguars and Maseratis and the Mercedes. And they'd be walking through the main reception area where, and my office is right off the reception area. So I see them all coming in. Meanwhile, you have guys that were contractors or painters or whatever that were in the lobby waiting to talk to somebody because we haven't paid bills for 3 months. So you had all these things going on at the same time. It kind of taught me, I said, you know what? If I fail at this and I'm out of work, I've just learned I can live longer without any money than I thought I could. And the team, I think, won the division, actually, in 1984, won the division. And then the off season, we should be marketing season tickets for the next year. But back in those days, there was no computers. So we would have to mail out season ticket renewal forms. And we couldn't do that because our Xerox machine, we hadn't paid the bill for 3 months. We knew the guy, Charlie, and he was a good guy. And we eventually bribed him because they wouldn't come out to fix the Xerox machine because it was part of the agreement because we were leasing it, whatever. And he couldn't come out. But he said, well, listen, we have airline script. We have Pan American airline script. You can fly anywhere in the world. Let us give you those Pan American airline scripts. In return, you'll fix the Xerox machine. We couldn't send out our postage of the season tickets because we had no money on the postal meter. So our marketing director, his wife worked at Channel 13 in LA. And so she would literally run the season ticket renewals through the postage machine at Channel 13 and mail them out. So we did a lot of stuff and we had some great characters. We had a guy named Eddie Meat Cleaver Weaver.
Yeah.
And Eddie, great nose tackle for University of Georgia on their national championship team with Herschel Walker. Eddie was a great guy and he had the biggest smile. He could light up the room. But when he wasn't smiling, he looked like the meanest guy. He was Mr. T. That's what he was, Mr. T without the mohawk. And I can remember one time we take Eddie to our weekly luncheon. And there's a lady named Liz Shanoff, who's a great news reporter for ABC Radio. And she just had transitioned into sports. So she's her first sports beat was the LA Express. So she's never interviewed athletes. And I can remember Eddie up the podium, you know, during the luncheon. And she says, well, you know, Steve Young, JoJo Townsend, Kevin Nelson, you know, they're you know, they get, seem to get all the publicity because they're playing skill positions. How does that make you feel, Eddie? And Eddie goes, what do you mean skill position? And she like melted on the floor. And then he smiled. Andy Bernstein, right? The photographer. And Andy started out one of his first gigs was doing LA Express football. And he went on, he's now in the Hall of Fame because he did all the Lakers photography and whatever. And he and I collaborated on a photo shoot that then ran back in the good old days, USA Today would run a photo shoot with Eddie in a butcher shop. He had steaks, he had chops on the chopping board. He even had a USFL football with hamburger in it. He had an apron. I can remember him always going, come on, man, I need more blood. No more blood on the apron. Got to get more blood on the apron. But anyway, ran the front page.
Eddie Meat Cleaver Weaver has got to be one of the top 10 nicknames in the history of pro sports.
I think so. That's a Chris Berman. He didn't come up with it, but that's a Chris Berman.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang. Oh, that's the name of the podcast. A quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. And I'm here with my dad, Stan Perlman, who's wearing a throwback Herschel Walker New Jersey Generals jersey from RoyalRetros.com. Dad, I'm confused. Why Herschel Walker?
You know, there just aren't that many Jews who play professional sports, so I wanted to support one of our greatest.
Dad, Herschel Walker's not Jewish.
Herschel Shmuel Walker, he most certainly is. I went down to Wrightsville, Georgia in 1977 to attend his bar mitzvah at the Wrightsville Ramada. Pickled herring was served. Wonderful time.
Dad, maybe it's senility, but Herschel Walker definitely isn't Jewish. He's Christian. He loves Trump. He thinks the earth is flat.
Why ruin an old man's dreams?
I did not know you spent the 1986 season with the St. Louis Cardinals. And the St. Louis Cardinals, 1986, 4-11-1, Coach Gene Stallings, the stoic former Alabama coach. You had Neil Lomax at quarterback. Your leading rusher was Stump Mitchell. You had Vi Sikahema. You had Roy Green. You spent 1 year in St. Louis, Missouri with the Cardinals. What was that? Why is that stop there on your resume?
Yeah, well, actually, I was there two seasons. Okay. I came in 86. I was going to hang in there with the USFL. By that point, I had left the LA Express, and I'm the PR guy for the legal office in New York. And we're about to get into the antitrust lawsuit with the NFL, and I'm already preparing stuff. So I thought it was kind of interesting how many people get that opportunity. So I was, even if I was going to eventually be out of a job, I was going to stay there. But then the St. Louis Cardinals, their vice president, Kurt Mosier, who was an old Dallas Cowboy PR guy, he called the legal office saying, hey, we'd like to talk to Bob Rose, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, they offered the job. But I had never been in the NFL, which I always thought that was probably the best PR job you can have in team sports. So I took the job. So I was there in 86 and 87 in St. Louis, the last 2 years in St. Louis. And then I moved with them to Phoenix. But I'll tell you a story. When I first came to the Cardinals, so obviously very inept franchise. And Bill Bidwell was not just the owner. He was also the general manager. Yeah, and I guarantee he wouldn't know how to put on you know, shoulder pads if his life depended, because he never played the game, but he was the general manager. And it was probably the old school way where they used to do it. So think about this. This is 1986. The NFC East is loaded, right? You've got every year is a team from the NFC East that's winning the Super Bowl. And so you've got George Young as the GM with the Giants. You've got Carl Peterson at the Eagles. You've got Tex Ram at the Cowboys, Bobby Beathard with the Redskins. And we've got Bill Biddle. On Monday mornings, there was a big, long conference table in the general area of the PR. There was like cubicles with PR, and I had my own office. But I can remember looking out there, first thing in the morning, this is after we got our ass handed to us on Sundays. And he would be at the conference table opening all the newspapers. And not only opening all the newspapers, pulling the comics out of the newspapers. And he's reading the comics all morning on Monday morning. And I'm going, I don't think George Young's doing this. You know, I don't think Bobby Beathard's doing this, right? And I really loved Gene Stallings. And he was probably the guy I was closest to, because I think and he was also one of those guys, because he had that, you know, Texas tough, you know, leathery skin. But if you knew him, he was one of the more compassionate people I've ever met. He was a wonderful person and a great coach, great defensive coach. But here's a story that kind of indicates just how woeful they were. So I get there, and I think the first thing I did was went to the NFL PR meetings, which was kind of weird. It was in Dallas, and I had just been the spokesperson for the USFL. So I'm making all these comments during the antitrust, and all of a sudden I'm on the other side. But then the draft is coming up right after. So I have the draft. We have like the sixth pick. And Dan Dierdorf is the king of St. Louis back then. I mean, he's a former player, but he was red hot. I mean, he was one of the Monday Night Football announcers. He had his own radio show on Camel X. He was a sports director of Camel X TV. Him and Jim Hart had these state houses. I mean, he had everything going on. And I didn't know Dan. I didn't know him. But he's at the draft. So he comes up to me, introduces himself. Hey, welcome to Cardinals, you know. He goes, now listen, here's the deal. They've been through a lot of PR guys. But I can tell you right now what's going to happen. We have a pool that the media can enter. We give them a list of what's projected, the top 20 picks in the draft. And out of those top list of 20, if you pay like $5, you get in the pool. He goes, but one person can pay $50 or $25, and they can pick somebody who's not on the list. Because the odds are they're going to pick somebody that's not on the list. So he goes, what's going to happen is they're going to pick somebody who's not on the list. I'm going to watch you running back into your office to try to get some information on this guy. So that particular year, he's absolutely right. They pick Anthony Bell from Michigan State. He's a linebacker. And of course, he's in the combine, he checked out. He ran a great 40-yard dash, you know, all the measurements. Problem was he had no instincts, which is kind of a bad thing, especially when you play linebacker, right? So all I remember is, as I'm running back to get information on him, Dierdorf goes into my other office. He calls up Bo Schembechler, who was his old coach. And Michigan had played Michigan State that year. So he asked him about Anthony Bell. And Bo goes, I'm not sure I know who he is. What was his number? And so what would happen, I think when I was there, they had like four or five first-round picks that were linebackers. And it was a weakness of the team. And the other thing that would always happen, because they picked somebody who wasn't supposed to be picked that high, but every year they take a stance, we're not going to pay you what would be the salary of a sixth pick. We're going to pay you what we think this guy's worth. And of course, the agent's immediately going to go, what are you talking about? He was picked fifth. That's the money you should get. And so every year they would have their first round pick would always hold out every year. And especially as a linebacker, that's a tough position to walk in and play. So anyway, that's what would happen. And Bernie Miklas, who I love, and I've lost touch with Bernie, but he was the beat writer. He wrote a long piece on the scouts. George Boone was the head of the scouts. And all I remember is like at training camp, they always left early from watching practice because they had to get back to make chili in the dorms where they stayed. And Bernie would refer to them in print as George Boone and the Moonshine Boys. Wow. And that was it. So, yeah, it was an interesting couple of years.
It's funny because, yes, Anthony Bell was a mistake. But the next year, the Cardinals made up for it with one of the great draft picks of all time with the number six pick.
Oh, I know you're talking about.
taking Kelly Stauffer out of Colorado State. So that worked out okay.
Yeah. Well, the thing was, if I remember right, first of all, Neil Lomax was a really great NFL quarterback. I mean, he's fourth on my list of guys I had, because besides Elway and Young, I also had Aaron Rodgers and Cal. So those years are pretty good, right? But I'd put Neil as my fourth best. But Neil had a congenital hip problem, and he kind of worked around it, and he ended up having a pretty good career. But I remember, right, Kelly Stauffer, this is a guy, they already had a guy who had a congenital hip problem, and they pick a guy, and he had something like that. He had some other issue. Yeah, and he never made it. Nice guy, too. But I was starting to relate with him, because even at that age, coming out of Colorado State, he was already losing his hair, which is exactly what I did at that age. So I'm going, this is my guy. Couldn't throw accurate passes.
You did work at Cal, and you had a very young Aaron Rodgers, and there was some Heisman talk. What do you remember about working with a young Aaron Rodgers?
Wow, impressive. Impressive. They kind of lucked out because he was not really recruited. They were recruiting a tight end from Butte Junior College up near Chico, where he grew up, and he was throwing passes to the tight end. Like, who is this guy? Here's my story that kind of indicates what kind of guy he was, because even back then, you could see his talent. But as you got to know him, you started to realize, man, this guy's really smart. I think what I tell people is, of all the people I've dealt, every athlete I ever dealt with, and I felt this way when he was at Cal, this is before he even got to the pros, I said, this is the guy with the most genuine self-confidence of anybody I've ever had, of any athlete. And the story I tell him, which is when I finally knew this guy's going to be good, is he's in like the third or fourth game of the season, his first year. And production meetings the day before a game. ABC's televising a game nationally with Keith Jackson and Dan Fouts at USC, 91,000 sellout crowd, and they're having the production meeting the night before. And the Cal's not ranked. Nobody knows who Aaron Rodgers is. But he says, I really like our game plan. I really think we're going to be able to move the ball. Now, this is the USC defense at that time was ranked number one in the country. And I thought, well, he's just saying that because that's what somebody's going to say at a production meeting, right? The next day, we play USC, and he completes the first 23 passes. And this is a tough environment, 23 in a row to start the game. And Tim Tesselung, the longtime SID, said, I've never seen a quarterback throw the ball like that, ever. And so that's when you kind of knew. The sad part was he never really got short Foley in college because the year they went 10-1, they had a hell of a team. You had Marshawn Lynch, you had J.J. Arrington and Justin Forsett. All three of those guys were top NFL guys. And it was only lost 10-1. They lost USC by 6 points. But by the end of the year, they were down to their fifth and sixth wide receivers with injuries. But I think people shouldn't forget that team. That was a really good team. If they hadn't had injuries, that team and the Joe Roth, Chuck Muncy team are clearly the two best Cals are at.
Wait, let me ask you a final question. Dusty Baker, as good as advertised?
The best. And I've had some good ones. You know, I think about people I've had along the way. Dusty is still a good friend. Yeah, and I left the Giants at a 1, at the end of a 1. So I've been his friend beyond the 10 years with him. He is such a great person. You know, what a human being. And you talk about, and I don't want him, he's still got a lot of years left. But when it's the time at the end of his life, he's one guy you can say, man, this guy lived a life. When I first got there, I started getting phone calls in the office, and it would be somebody trying to reach Dustin. Because, yeah, I'm a friend of Dustin's. And eventually, I never said it, but I used to think, hey, take a number, buddy. You know, there's a lot of guys that are friends of Dustin. What I love about Dusty, he's kind of got it all, right? He's a superstar, right? I mean, he is a superstar. You walk in and, Deion Sanders doesn't have anything on Dusty. I'm telling you, Dusty's a big presence. But he's also got a humility about him. He's lived life. He's failed. He's had a lot of things he's overcome. So he has those things. But I think the other thing I just love is he just respects everybody. And he respects what you do. Well, the first year with him in 93, and of course, he'd already been a coach for a while and he was a player for a long time. And we go to every ballpark that we play and everybody knows him. All the ushers know him. The groundskeepers know him. as busy as you are, you're the manager, you got a lot going on. When you walk into his office and you're having a bad day, he'll sense it. He'll say, Bob, what's wrong? And you'll tell him something that, you know, upstairs they're not doing something right or they're doing me wrong. And it would bother him. That would bother, genuinely bother him. So, yeah, he's the best.
Well, listen, Bob, first of all, I appreciate you doing this. And second of all, you know, I kind of buried the lead here, which is I really want to work on a reunion. I think Barry Bonds needs a personal publicist. And I was thinking that if you'd be up for it, you know, I can hook you up with the guy and maybe.
Well, you know what? I do believe that people can change.
Yeah.
I want Barry to just kind of face up. You know, we all make mistakes. We even had bad stretches in life. What's happened is what we all kind of thought. He's not fully getting the love and the appreciation for all the accomplishments he did do, because he was doing these things way before the steroid era. But I also think that he has to own it. He has to own it. Yep. And until he does that, you know, it's tough to feel sorry.
I actually think he's a great lesson. I swear to God, I really do. I've said this before. If you treat people like shit, it does come back to you. It just comes back.
It's all those stories. It's like what comes around goes around. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but it's kind of sad. You know, it's kind of one of those things that's kind of sad. You know, when you think about it, it's got to be driving him crazy to see A-Rod. Fox cannot put him on TV enough.
I know.
Right? It's got to be driving very nuts.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, I appreciate you doing this.
My pleasure.
I want to thank today's guest, Bob Rose, for joining me on Two Writers Singing Yang. You can learn more about Bob by visiting his website, bobrose-pr.com. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.